Hello guys, welcome to this session. This is how to become an IoT developer, and here with us is Justin. Hope you enjoy the session.
I was going to say, I hope you weren't leaving then.
Hi, welcome everyone. My name's Justin McLean. I'm a freelance developer. I work for myself. I've been programming for about 25 years. So during that time, I've done quite a few things. I'm involved in Apache in the incubator, PMC, where most of you may have probably seen me, maybe, I don't know. I'm also on the Flex PMC and a few others as well, and I'm an Apache member and a mentor of several incubating projects. Why I'm talking about IoT today, though, is that I happen to run the IoT meetup in Sydney, Australia. We have 1,800 members. I get about 100 people turning up at once. If they all 1,800 showed up at once, it would be a disaster because I could no way fit them in the room. But it's fun. And that's what we're here to really talk about is my journey along the way and how I got into this and, you know, what here. So just hands up, who here has actually done some IoT style work? One, two, good. So the rest of you are all newbies. That's great because that's who this talk is aimed at. So how I got here. I've been coding since the 80s, so that's a while. I'm probably a little older than you think I am. Anyway. So back when I started, I basically learned C and machine code. And the first couple of large projects that I worked on were what you would call IoT projects. They weren't called IoT back then. But they involved hardware. I worked on a project for Sydney Water, which was a SCADA system. And I also worked on the election broadcast system for the ABC. So that took all various bits of hardware devices and made a live video feed on election night to show who was winning the election. Then the internet came along, and I sort of got more interested in that. It was sort of new and shiny, and So I stopped doing this. Oh, I also worked on a telephone exchange. Yeah, that was hard. Writing telephone exchanges is hard. And a few years later, I noticed this open source hardware thing, and I thought, you know, I actually did enjoy some of the hardware stuff that I used to play on back in earlier on in my career. I wonder what sort of happened in this space. So I did a bit of investigation. I found a few non-open source and open source hardware projects, the Arduino being one of them, the Arduino platform. I got really interested in that, more as a hobby. I wasn't making money out of it or anything like that. And then that got me into speaking at conferences. So the very first talk I gave at a conference was on Arduinos. I've now spoken at 50 or 60 conferences, I think. I don't know, I've lost count. So, lots is the answer. And from that, at a conference, I happened to meet Alexandria DS, who runs the Internet of Things in London, the meetup there, and she said, is there one in Sydney? And I said, no, and she said, you should start it. And I said, oh, okay, I think I can do that. And yeah, as I said, 3 years later, it's now 1,800 people, so yeah, that worked out well. And I've actually gone back to coding in C and working on hardware again. One of my current jobs, being a freelance developer, I usually have several jobs at a time, I'm actually working on an embedded device that plugs into your car and works out how well you're driving. It's got an accelerometer, Bluetooth, GPS, 3G modem in there, and I'm writing the software to coordinate all the devices and trying to do it. So even though I've been programming for 30 years, I'm actually coming back to doing exactly the same thing as what I was doing 30 years ago, which is sort of odd. Please ask questions along the way. I might have some time for questions at the end, but I prefer if you ask them as we go. So what has changed in that 30 years? The answer is a lot, but maybe not as much as you think. So we now have access to low-cost hardware. That is a big game changer. Like for $20 or $30, you can buy a little development board and you can start playing around and doing it yourself. The devices that you can buy for that money have greatly improved. welcome, welcome. Grab a seat. So, things that just were not possible at all. If I think back to the election broadcast system that I worked on, we bought the most expensive video cards we could get at the time, and I think they were of the order of about 10 grand each. They took up 2 ISA slots and had 16 meg of memory. Like, meg, not gig, meg. So, for the CPUs that used to power the computers, your desktop computers of a decade or two ago, now run your microwaves and washing machines and things like that, and they're cheap. They cost $10 or $20 in bulk. So, also, you can use modern IDEs to develop on these platforms. I put modern in inverted commas there because sometimes they're a bit clunky and sometimes they're not quite as modern as you would like. But it's still an IDE. You still can. And a lot of the platforms support modern debugging features, like you can step-by-step line through the code, you can watch set breakpoints, you can look at variables and so forth. So the development process is not entirely different to other development process developing for embedded things. There's some differences, which I'll certainly go through, but it's much the same as you would expect. There's also been some standardization in electronics and the way that electronic components talk to each other. And again, I'll speak a little bit about that later. Open source hardware has happened. This is absolutely amazing. It means you can take off-the-shelf designs and you can use them as your own products. You have a community that is built around these products that can, you know, help you get done what you want. You know, you don't have to know everything to be able to work on these sort of platforms. Hi, welcome. And there's heaps of source code out there, open source libraries. In particular, if you look at the Adreno platform, just about any device you want to talk to, someone has already done it. There will be code out there. You can use that code. So, hardware is hard. I'm sure people have heard that saying. And it is hard in some cases. And it's hard for a number of reasons. One is that it's actually a physical thing, and once you make it and ship it out in the field, it's hard to change it. You can't just do revert. And sometimes things don't quite work the way that you think they will, and I'll go through a few examples as well. Developing software for hardware can be difficult as well. And sometimes it's the things that you don't expect to be difficult that are. And I'll go through a few examples again. And it definitely takes more time to debug and find errors in hardware. The first problem that you've got, if something's not working, it's like, well, is it the software or is it the hardware? I don't know. Looks like it works. So it's that can be a little tricky. So just, you know, put more time down for than what you think it would do. Once you do have these devices up in the field, and you want to change the software on them, how do you do that? That is one of the biggest problems. And there are ways and solutions around that, but you need to factor that in from the beginning and not try to retrofit it. That would be a big mistake. Security is a very big problem. I'm sure everyone's heard of recent security issues involving IoT-style devices. And power is also a problem. So, depending on what sort of device you're making or what you're creating, you're going to have to power it in some way, and battery life may be a consideration, so you might have to have it wake up every 10 minutes or so, do something really, really quickly, and then go back to sleep again. We had a great talk before, I don't know if anyone was in the room, on Cassandra and cattle. He was talking about a system that had cattle had little tags on them, which had a temperature probe in the ear. We were talking about more than 1 million cattle sending all this data all at once and how to deal with that, which was quite an interesting talk. So who here wants to be an IoT developer? Hopefully everyone. I'm coming up at the angle because you're going to learn new interesting things and it's fun to do. But if that's not what motivates you, that's okay. It's going to be probably a $20 trillion industry in the next decade, you may want some of that money. There's good employment opportunities there. So, you know, you need to start investigating, having a look around, and start down this path of doing that. So this is sort of... just one thing, yeah, before I start on that. The whole word IoT means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And you can be an IoT developer and not touch hardware at all. Like, you can be involved in the big data end of things and play around with Cassandra and Spark and whatever, and just consume all the data and analyze it and so forth. I'm going to focus on more the other end, and that is, you're a software developer, but you need to know a little bit about hardware, and you're writing the software that actually gets embedded on this hardware and and does that sort of thing. So, first off, play with some toys. Get yourself an Arduino. Who here has an Arduino board? Right, at least a quarter of you. Right, they're cheap, they're very easy to use. Or a Raspberry Pi if that's more your thing. If you're more familiar with Linux and you want to go down that path, then do that. And the best way to do this is to find yourself a project. You know, make a little weather reporting station, make a little robot. That's probably a bit ambitious as your first project. But, depending on your skill level and what you're comfortable with, if you brew beer, okay, make a temperature logger to look at how your beer is brewing. If you've got a cat and you have a white cat and the next door neighbor has a black cat, make a cat flap that detects the color of the cat that comes in and only opens for your cat and not the black one. You know, so just come up with something silly and crazy and just play around with it. And that will get you started. So this is the Arduino board, for people who don't know it. This is it comes in many form factors and shapes. This is a good development board for prototyping and so forth. Again, they're cheap, easy to use. This is the IDE, very simple, not Eclipse. Right, there's only a few buttons up the top there. The code is C or C++. Don't let that scare you. Who here knows C? About a third of the room again? Yeah, all right. I'll get to that. So, first off, you've got to get some stuff. You need an Arduino board, you probably need a breadboard and some wires, you might need a few components and some breakout boards. Here's a couple of places up on the board where you can find these places. Adafruit Sparkphone are based in the US. I order stuff from them from Australia as well. C Studio is based in Hong Kong. And you can also get stuff cheap off eBay, but you get what you pay for there. I'll come to that a little later. So, let's start off by creating a simple circuit. Get a breadboard, some wires, put something together, see if you can make it work. The biggest barrier I find, I run training courses on Arduino, and the biggest barrier I find to people who come from a software background is they think they're gonna break something. Like, they're going to let the magic smoke out. It's really hard to do that. It is possible, but it's hard to do that. Electronics, one of the other things that happened with electronics along the way is they used to be quite static sensitive. And they would occasionally just malfunction for no apparent reason whatsoever. These days, you can handle them pretty roughly. You don't have to take any static precautions. You don't have to use anti-static strips for most electronics. Like, don't rub your feet on the car and do that. But, other than that, you're not going to damage things. Over the probably decade now, almost, that I've been working with Arduino boards, I have not managed to destroy one board. And I've done some pretty evil things to them. I have, on the other hand, blown up quite a few leads. So, but they're easily replaceable, It's not a big deal. And a few capacitors, actually, when I think about it. But anyway. Right, so you've got your idea for your prototype. You managed to work out what components you want to get. Just try and put it together on a breadboard with some wires and see what happens. You may need a multimeter to help you out here. You don't need a lot of tools to get started, but having a few tools is definitely going to help. It may not look pretty. There's usually two styles to breadboards. One has wires all over the place like this, The other, you cut wires to lengthen, lay them out, and make it neat looking. I'm more the sort of messy person, but depending on who you are and your personality, you may want to prefer something else. So this is just a very simple circuit that has some LEDs in it, and I'll plug a battery in and they'll light up in some way. And you want to control those in some way with code. So please, any questions at all, ask. Just stick your hand up.
I think to get started without the fear of breaking anything, I think Autodesk has this 123D website. That was cool because...
Okay. Not for everyone. I actually think... what I like what they've done. This is the 123... 123D, yeah, that's what it's called. It's a simulator. You don't get the same experience using a simulator as you do with the real hardware. Particularly when I'm running the courses, I notice there's this moment where people's eyes just suddenly light up and they realize, hey, I've just got something to go from hardware. I fiddle this knob to software. It's reading that, and then that's doing something else and turning on a light. So you don't get the same appreciation. You can do it in a simulator, and you can still write the code, but really all you're doing is writing code. You're not getting the physical hands-on practice that I think you need with the hardware to make it a better learning experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. But everyone is different and learns in different ways, so for some people that may be a good thing to do. Breakout boards. Spark Fun in particular makes lots and lots and lots of breakout boards. They get the very latest chips, they make little tiny boards for you, they put the chips on there, they give them nice little headers so you can plug them into breadboards, so you can quite easily get a whole lot of different components, solder a few headers on, and hook it up to a breadboard and you have something that works. It's electronics has become more like Lego. You can just get the bits and plug them together. A lot of these components use standard interfaces. I2C and SPI are the two main ones. Arduino platform, for example, understands those protocols very easily. You don't have to write a lot of code to be able to talk to something like that. So if you get, for example, this is an air quality sensor. That's much, much bigger than it is, by the way. It's tiny. So, for an example, the spacing between these holes here is a mil, and that is, I'm going to remember it right, it's a weird combination of metric and imperial measurement. It's 1/10 of an inch. So that's what you have to deal with in electronics. So that's a few mil by, I don't even know what that is. That's probably about an inch, I would guess. Maybe smaller. So you can just get a couple of these boards, hook them up on a breadboard, and they're reasonably inexpensive depending on you know what you want to try and put together. Learn how to solder. How do you say solder? Sorry, it's... Yeah.
No, sorry. You ask if somebody soldered.
Yeah, you don't say the L, do you? It's solder.
I say solder, but I don't know.
Anyway, you know what I mean. So, get a decent soldering iron. You don't have to buy the most expensive one. Just, sort of anything between the $20 and $50 mark, you can generally find a good one. Make sure it's got a small tip on it, though. You don't want a really big tip, particularly as components are getting smaller and smaller. Use a flux pen. If you don't know what a flux pen is, I've got one in my bag. Yeah, I do. That's a flux pen. Actually, I cheated. This is actually like an art ink pen that I've just filled with flux. So it's got a little paintbrush on the end, and you can just paint things on it, and it will make soldering stuff much, much, much easier. It takes, comes around a job. Don't sniff it. So, it just makes stuff so much easier. And if you get into a habit of using that from the beginning, you'll find you'll make far less mistakes. Another thing, if you look at little videos online about how to solder and so forth, it's a little disappointing because they always show you the perfect way to do things, and they're precise every single time, generally. It's like, no, I want to see something where people stuff up and then show me how to fix that. And there's lots of... When you first start out, you will make mistakes. You'll get solder bridges. You'll heat things up too much and maybe burn the tracks off things in worst case. It just takes a little bit of practice and... you just need to know how to correct your mistakes. Like, if you've got a solder bridge, the easy way to fix a solder bridge is to stick your soldering iron between the two pins and just flick sideways, and it's no longer a solder bridge. So have a look at that. Start with large items first. Large through-hole items are easy to solder. There's a trend in electronics for several decades now to being smaller and smaller and smaller components. You can hand solder them, even little tiny ones, but you need practice. And maybe a steady hand and maybe a microscope in some cases. A stereo microscope. If you're soldering ICs when you first start out, use sockets. It's easy to solder a socket. You can fix up a socket. You're not going to, and if you overheat it, you're just going to melt a bit of plastic on the socket. It doesn't matter. And you can just plug the IC into there. So, also for fixing up mistakes, solder braid is absolutely fantastic. It's basically a threaded copper cable that's flat. You stick it on the solder joint, you apply the heat, and it sucks up all the solder. So you can unsolder things with that. The other tool that you commonly use is like a vacuum pen thing. I don't particularly like those. They tend to be a bit cumbersome and don't really work very well. But again, some people like them, so whatever. It's not hard. So once you've learned a little bit of this and played around a little bit, you might end up with a prototype like this. So this is just an Arduino shield, so that plugs in top of an Arduino. It's using a prototype board, sometimes called the Perf board. There's a few different ways you can make prototypes, either with a board like this, where you can get even like a bare PCB that is just strips. And you can cut the strips. You can use a drill bit for doing that, or there's a few other ways of making prototypes. But you can make a prototype fairly quickly in half an hour or so. If you're new at this, it may take you a little bit longer, but it's easy enough to do. Again, any questions, please ask. So, most of you don't know C. Learn C. It's not as hard as you think. If you start off in the Arduino, you probably don't even recognize that it's C. Right? They hide all the ugly bits away from you. Mostly what you're doing is coding against an API. You're using C syntax, and if you write some of your own code, but it's not going to be complex. You don't have to worry about pointers, you don't have to worry about memory allocation, particularly when you're starting out. And that's the thing that most people will have trouble with who, say, come from a Java background or some other background.
This is me.
Now you can... There are other languages you can use on embedded systems. You can get boards that run JavaScript. You can get boards that run Python. You can get boards that run Ruby, I think. Don't be tempted by those. It's you're not going to learn anything. Like, you already know how to code in JavaScript. Why do you want to code in JavaScript on the embedded platform? Just learn C. It's not hard. And most developers who have been in the industry for a while know more than one language. Knowing more than one language will help you solve problems in different ways in other languages as well. So it's, learn C. Now, if you do know C, you may have to forget some of what you know, because the way that you code in C on embedded platforms is probably a little different to how you code in C on, Visual Studio, Windows, desktop applications. I'll go a bit into that. Also, the modern style C, the way that you code it is a little different. So let's have a look at a very, very simple Arduino program. Can anyone tell me what I've done here? There's two things probably that you would generally never do in any coding language. Look at line one. What have I done there? Anyone? I have a global variable. Yes, right? That's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, in fact, it's useful. It's useful for a number of reasons, because you're generally writing fairly small programs, and what that does is that sets up reserves the memory for that variable upfront and always, and it means that you know you're not going to have any issues with dynamic memory allocation. You're not going to run out of memory. You're not going to run into other issues. This is a very simple example, but that's sort of a rule in general. Anyone else can see the other thing that I've got there that you generally don't do? You probably have to know a little bit about the Adreno language to know about it. I've got this loop method. What this loop method does, is exactly as it says, is it loops forever. It's an infinite loop. So quite often on embedded systems, you're going to have several infinite loops or more of them. And you might have some of them sort of running concurrently, if that makes sense. But yeah, that's the way you do. Go-tos considered harmful? No, go-tos are great. Go-tos can actually really, really simplify your code, particularly around error handling and things like that. Yeah?
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
The infinite loop, for someone who never seen Arduino, it's not an infinite loop because it's just a function.
Yeah.
I know that it causes...
I know that, but you maybe would not know that, yeah. Because... If I actually got the C code that this produces, it creates a main program that has a 4 semicolon, semicolon, semicolon in it. So, yeah. I get that. The point is that you may have to code in ways that you've been told is bad. And, you know, that's just how it is. You might want to read this book if you don't know C. This is the classic book. Now, this was written, 85, 86, something like that. So it's old, but it's still relevant today. If you don't want to read that book, I'd say read this one. This is the more modern one. And it goes a lot more into the way that modern C is used in terms of libraries and languages and makefiles and things. It's probably a little more advanced for a beginner, but it's got a lot of good material in it. So C has improved over the years. There's been several versions. There's the K&R C, which what I was taught when I went to university. But there was C89, I think it was a C90 as well, and there's a C99 and now there's a C11. And it's improved, maybe just a little bit. All the versions of C are backwards compatible with the previous versions. Most embedded systems that you're going to be playing with would understand C99. And that's sort of nice because they've added a few features in there that will help you. They've added some new types. So you actually have a Boolean type, which is very, very handy in coding. They also have integer types of fixed sizes. One of the biggest problems I've come across in C is you'll just declare something as an int. You'll run it locally, and locally that's 64 bits. You run it on the embedded system, and it's only 16 bits or 32 bits. So you get subtle bugs that happen that won't happen normally because things overflow and all the rest. So there's now a whole lot of int types that specify the size. So if you know what the size is, you're not going to make those sort of problems. So that's a good thing to use. They've got some nice features like auto-sizing arrays, floating point numbers can be added as well, which is nice. They've got a whole lot of libraries for those. Inline functions for optimization is also a good feature as well, but don't overuse that. Generally, the compilers are really, really good. You don't have to overly optimize your code. The compiler will do that for you. So don't try and be clever. Don't try and write stuff that's arcane and you're going to forget what it does 10 minutes later. I'm a big believer in just writing very simple, straightforward code and letting the compiler do the hard work for you. Then if you have any performance problems, then go ahead and optimize it. So a few other things that you may want to do is there's a whole lot of operator orders in C, and there's a lot of shortcut evaluations that C takes advantage of. So if it knows if a complex expression, if it's already false at the beginning, it's not going to bother calculating the rest of it. So if you put your if statements and Boolean conditions in the right order, that's going to help the compiler so much more. And there's a few other things along those lines as well, but as you get more familiar with it, you'll be able to find out what those are. Okay, so the biggest problem in C is that you have to do the memory management yourself. Well, you don't have to. You don't have to use new at all malloc, or you don't have to use dynamic memory allocation yourself. Just as an example, on one of the projects I'm currently working on, it's an embedded device, plugs into your car, and basically works out how well you're driving. Now, I don't have any dynamic memory allocation in that program at all, and that's by design, because that means you're guaranteed that there's no memory leaks, and the device, you know, is going to run for a long time without falling over. And the reason that you can do this on embedded devices now is that the memory has actually become decent. Now, by decent, I'm talking 128K, 256K, something along those lines. But that doesn't sound like a lot, but that is a lot. So a lot of stuff you can pre-allocate up front as static variables or as local variables. And if you run through your code once and it all fits into memory, then that's great. You don't have to worry about it. So when you come to optimization, you may have to make some dynamic memory allocation, but then you've got to be careful that you're not going to run out of memory at some point in time. Pointers are another thing that people who are not familiar with C sort of get a bit confused about. Just use them sensibly. It's not that hard. It's pointer arithmetic can actually be really, really useful, and you can write very concise code with it. And that's code that's understandable as well. But used wrongly, like almost any feature in any language, you can end up with a confusing mess that is really hard to debug, and you get null pointer exceptions and all sorts of other things. So, break it up, lots of little functions. That gives you an overhead from the each function call, but you can always inline the functions. The compiler will automatically inline some stuff for you as well. So it's, you know, it's not really a big deal. Again, you know, optimize things later. The integers that I was talking about before, use the sized ones. That way you're not going to run into any problems with overflowing or arithmetic that gives you the wrong answers. Just a bit of verse. Strings can be a little bit difficult in C. You've got to take extra care with those. The standard library with string manipulation, in recent versions of C, they've added a few safer functions. That means if you copy a string to somewhere else, you're not going to overwrite the end of the buffer. Use those instead of the standard functions that you may have been used to if you know a little bit of C beforehand. And also, just like JavaDocs, there's a thing called Deoxygen, and that will generate documentation from your code, and that's always a good idea to do that. You can do a lot in a small amount of code. On an Arduino platform, for example, 20 lines of code will give you a web server. That compiles down to about 2K. If you compile a web server on another machine, it's like you're going to expect megs. So you can do a lot. So here's something I really like. This is from a project I was working on a little while ago. Doesn't look like much. So what this is doing, this is taking in basically time, which is a counter, just increases by one as it goes along. It's doing some bit arithmetic on it with some shifts and some masks. And you might think, what the hell is that doing? Well, it's actually taking advantage of overflow and bit arithmetic. It's basically, it's a German formula. And the best way to think of it is of an ordered random number generator. It's actually a pattern generator is the best way to do it. And you can use this to generate music that is actually listenable to. It's a bit electronic sounding, but it works. Or you can use it to make lights blink in ordered patterns. So with one line of code, you can produce millions of different patterns of code of lights. So you can be very concise with a little bit of trickery, but So sometimes you have to know when to bend the rules, and sometimes overflowing things and so forth can produce interesting results. You need to know a little bit of electronics, but not much. I think this is about all you need to know, and you don't need to know all this up front. Generally, you're going to focus on digital logic, because you're going to be turning things on and off, or detecting whether something is turned on or off. You're going to be playing with lights. That's generally one of the first things people do. You know, like flashy, blinky lights. Well, I do, anyway. Chris doesn't, I know. So you're going to have to work out how to limit the current to those leads, and there's a few ways of doing that. Mostly simplest way is using a resistor, and you've got to work out the right value of the resistor, but it's a simple formula for doing that. You need transistors for switching, capacitors to make power supplies reliable, pull down resistors for switches and for some communication buses. And just a voltage divider. Mostly they're used for sensors and so forth. All of these are very, very simple circuits. They only require a couple of components. You can learn this in under a day or so. Make a board. Why? Because it's actually fun. This is what I was saying before about simulators. Yeah, they have their place, but having actually something hands-on and making something physical, I think you're going to get a lot more out of it. So start off with a basic PCB layout program like Fritzing. There are other programs out there, but they're aimed at professionals, and they're much more complex, and they're much harder to use initially. Fritzing is good. So one of the good features about Fritzing is that it's got a breadboard view. So you can take what you've done on the breadboard, do it visually in the program, and then switch to the PCB view, and then drop and drag all your components together. And it will have done all the wiring for you. It will have already done most of the work for you. So you can actually make a PCB without knowing much about electronics at all. So it's really interesting. So a couple of things you've got to be careful about is don't cross any of the tracks. That gives a short circuit, that's not a good thing. Vias are tracks between one side of the board and the other side of the board. Sometimes to stop tracks from going over each other, you either have to go under a component, or you need to go to the bottom of the board, along the bottom of the board, and then up again. So these are quite easily to do. And then to make the circuit a little better, generally you have a ground fill on the bottom of the board and copper fill on the top. It also means that they use less chemicals in making the board, so that's a good idea. And Fritzing will do all of that for you automatically, so just with a couple of menu selections. I seem to have a slide out of place, but never mind. While you're making the board, most of the components, if you didn't buy them off eBay, will come with a data sheet. And the data sheet will tell you important things about the component. They're complex, they'll have a lot of information in it that you won't understand. Don't be so concerned about that. Just look for the obvious things, i.e. is it running at the voltage that I need it to run at? How much current does it consume? So I know that my battery power is not going to be flat in 2 seconds. So just a couple of those obvious things, if you look for those, you'll be able to work out how to use it. They also often contain sampled circuits, which is great, because it means then that you can use that in your design. And professional electrical engineers have tested and tried this circuit out, so it's a good thing to copy. In a couple of cases, particularly with, they'll contain important timing information. Sometimes that's useful, sometimes it's not. Generally, if it's an SPI bus, it's an SPI bus and it'll just work. But I occasionally run into a few issues where, I can't quite run it at that speed. I've got to run it at a slightly slower speed to be able to talk to this particular device. Data sheets, like documentation for code, can vary hugely in quality. So when you're selecting components, you may want to look at several data sheets and see which one is the best and has the best documentation and go with that, even though it might be a cent or two more expensive for the actual component itself.
Need to know a little bit about schematics.
just what the basic symbols are and how to match up the pins on an IC. That's the data. And here's a sample schematic. This is an accelerometer. And you can see that you have a whole lot of pins connected to ground, which is 0 volts, over here, and we have some 3.3 volts up the top there, so that's what is powering the chip. And there's a few capacitors filtering the power over there, but that's about it, other than just what pins are connected to what. There's actually an error in the circuit, by the way, which I'll get to a little later. You probably won't be able to recognise where the error is, but I'll point to pin number 22. So, fritzing, as I was saying, very easy to use. Look, other good thing about fritzing is if you've got a breadboard view, you've got a PCB view, you can export the Gerber files from fritzing, send them off to a manufacturer, and they can make the boards for you. And you can do this cheaply. To actually manufacture boards these days, it's a few dollars a board for a small board. And it's about 1 or 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks turnaround time. But you know, you can fit that around doing other things, and if you've got several projects on the go, then that works quite well. You can pay more for quicker shipping and so forth, but that's how it is. It handles surface mount and through the hole components, so when you start off your project, you can use through hole components, and then you can change them to surface mount later and make the board smaller. So it's got quite a lot of nice features. It also comes with little footprints of features, and it also, both Adafruit and SparkFun have provided libraries to be used in fritzing, so that all your stuff can be used there. So that helps a lot as well. You don't have to design your own footprints for stuff, which can be time-consuming and difficult. Two things that it doesn't do: the breadboard view is not quite as compact as I was like. It's sort of an odd. You can't cram things together as you can physically on a breadboard. You have to space them out a little bit. And it also has an auto route feature, which basically, if you put all your components on the board and say auto route, what it's supposed to do is work out how all the tracks can connect to each other without crossing over. So it tries to do all that hard work for you. It generally doesn't do a good job of it. For simple stuff, it works well. For complex stuff, it just, nah, sorry. But and I think you learn a bit more by just laying it out yourself. So this is the breadboard view. So you can see from the circuit that I had before, you've got an Arduino there, you've got a breadboard, you've got some LEDs in there, you've got the resistors, exactly the same circuit. And then you can just click on the PCB view, and this is all drop and drag. You don't have to know much about electronics or anything about electronics at all. You just sort of connect pins to pins and then make sure the tracks don't overlap anything. Again, anyone here would you know, playing around this for a day would be able to make a circuit, no problem at all. And this is what the boards look like when you get them made. So, professional quality boards, as I said, a few dollars each. So at this stage you probably need a few more tools. Get yourself a decent soldering iron, get a multimeter, get a nice pair of side cutters, flex pen. That will save your life. Or make things much, much, much easier for you. Solder brake to, you know, get rid of mistakes. And if you're doing surface mount components, you can get very cheap heat guns these days that'll allow you to either solder components or desolder components, mostly desolder, because you will make mistakes. Multimeter for some people who don't know what one looks like. Who here has used a multimeter? Okay, again, another quarter group, okay. They're not hard to use. To start off with, you can use them. The best thing you'd use them for is to test conductivity. So they have a beep mode. You put one lead on one pin, one lead on another pin, and it'll tell you whether those two pins are connected. So you can use that to detect whether the circuit is as you think it is, or whether there's a short circuit that shouldn't be there. You can also measure current and voltage and resistance. They're useful multi-purpose tools, and they're not expensive. Something like that is $30. So something along those lines, maybe $40. And then once you've got the board back, it works. I think I'm running a little bit out of time, but we'll see how we go. So, and Fritzing, you can make very complex boards with it. You don't have to just make simple boards. So, some of the problems you might run into. Don't go too small too quickly. Don't make a tiny little board with lots of surface mount components on it, because it's going to be really hard to debug if there's an error with the board. Boards may have high defects like, so I got 16 boards made the other day, and what they did was when they were panelizing them, they took the first column, copied and pasted to the other three columns, and they left one track out. So only four of the boards worked. And this was because the boards are so small. So you have to be careful with that. Have some way of testing the hardware. Put physical test spots on the hardware. Make a testing rig if you need one, if you want to test the number of boards. You think about this beforehand too, don't think about it afterwards. It's hard to retrofit this sort of stuff. Don't use the hardware at all. It's another thing you can do. C generally runs everywhere, so compile and run your code on your laptop. The workflow is generally going to be faster. You're going to be able to unit test your code. You can get a lot more things happening there than... some platforms do have simulators. They can be useful. But don't rely on them 100%. Because at the end of the day, you've got to test it on the hardware. And if you test it on the hardware, you make sure you test the release build as well as debug. You can get subtle timing issues. I've run into this a few times where you run the debug stuff and it works fine, you run the release stuff and no, it doesn't work. That can be hard to debug and work out what's gone wrong. Generally it's a timing issue or a concurrency issue or something along those lines, but you need to be aware of that. Watch your memory. These devices have small amounts of memory. You can do a lot in a small amount of memory, but you can still possibly run out of memory at some point in time. Most modern IDEs that work with embedded systems will have some way of you visualizing that memory and working out how much is being taken up at any point in time. And they will tell you how much the code compiles down to, and they also tell you if you've got lots of different tasks running, how much memory each task is running, and if any of those tasks are running out of stack or heap space. So use that feature. Do a burn-in test. Make sure your hardware runs for 24 hours, unsupervised. There's nothing worse than making something and then finding that it falls over after 6 hours of use. So that's not good. It's always your fault. If something doesn't work, it's going to be the software, not the hardware. If you can't find the bug, it's still going to be the software. It's in your code, not someone else's code. No, changing libraries will not fix it. Yes, it's going to be your bug. So I've run into this a few times and you think, it's got to be the hardware, it's got to be the hardware. But no, it's not. It's generally you. So you've got to be really careful and look, you know, closely for what's going on there. Except when it is the hardware. So most of the time when hardware doesn't work, it just doesn't work. Or it has a short in it and it catches fire. If you're really, really unlucky, it will mostly work. And I've had a few incidents of this recently. Some GPS antennas that were unmarked were passive antennas, not active antennas. So they worked some of the time. Thank you. Crystals that controlled the clock to chips were rotated 90 degrees on the board, so some of them worked some of the time, some of the boards didn't work at all. It was like, and then when they did work, the rates of transmitting data was unreliable and very slow. That one took a while to work out, because the crystals are square too. That accelerometer circuit I showed you before had an incorrect line to +5 volts on an optional clock. which means you could talk to the accelerometer, you can set values and so forth, but you never got any readings from it. So sometimes it is the hardware, you've got to be careful for that. I'm a little bit out of time, I'm sorry. So I'm just going to skip to the end. And I'm going to talk just very quickly about two of the bad things, over-the-air updates. This is complex. It's going to cause you a lot of problems. Find a real-time operating system that does this for you. That is the easiest solution. And the other thing is security. Security can be really, really hard on these constrained devices. You may not be able to run TLS because of this. Just select a platform that has crypto built into it, or get another crypto chip that will do it for you. Don't try and do it yourself. There's nothing worse than roll your own security, because all chances are you're not a security expert and you're going to do something wrong. And so that's my journey on this sort of path. I've learned a lot of new things. I've met a lot of nice people. I've been involved in some really interesting communities. Hopefully your journey will be the same. And thank you.